This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, there's a lot going on. Teddy Kennedy, Patrick Kennedy, Carolyn Kennedy, all coming out and saying, yeah, Barack Obama, he's like Jack. Amazing. It's extraordinary. The phenomena of Barack Obama rolling across this country following the vote on Saturday. We will get into that as we continue on throughout the day. But just an extraordinary victory, and congratulations to Barack Obama on that. And tonight, of course, the President's State of the Union address. We will be speaking about the State of the Union as we continue in our program today. And right now, legislatively, the House fiscal stimulus package has moved over to the Senate, and the Senate's tweaking it today. And by the way, speaking of the Senate, let me just, again, I'll mention this again throughout the program, but today is the day the Senate's going to vote on the FISA legislation on whether or not to let Bush, Cheney, and company and all their big corporate cronies and donors avoid being prosecuted for the crimes that they committed, spying on you, me, and on the Democrats in Congress, among others, without warrants. And so I would suggest that if you're interested in that issue, you may want to go to callcongress.org and call your members of Congress, your senators specifically, your two senators. Each state has two senators. Call your two senators and say, no immunity on FISA. Real simple. But the issue that we want to talk about right now is this whole economic stimulus package that the House has sent over to the Senate and that the President would like to be able to have a discussion about tonight, I think, in his State of the Union address. And Alex Epstein is with us. Alex is an analyst at the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. I always find the perspective of the Ayn Rand Institute to be particularly fascinating and interesting and useful for all of us, because Ayn Rand, with her book Atlas Shrugged and her many writings on objectivism, probably her most famous pure follower is Alan Greenspan, although there have been others. They're the people who inspired the modern libertarian movement and the most conservative streak in the modern conservative movement and the neoconservative movement, although they disclaim all and consider themselves the purists to precede them. Anyhow, Alex, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Great to be back.
Great to have you with us. So the economy looks a little shaky, and the Democrats and the Republicans are getting together, and it looks to me, frankly, like the Republicans are helping to craft this legislation in such a way that most of the stimulus, the checks will go out May to July, the corporate tax breaks will take effect October, that most of the stimulus is going to be hitting the economy September, October, November, just in time to help the Republicans in the national election. They'll be able to say, what economic problems? And this seems to me like politics is normal. Your take on all this?
Well, my take on this is that the whole concept of a stimulus package of this sort that's designed to encourage spending, I think, is completely misconceived. I mean, basically, spending means consumption. And the whole issue in economics and the whole issue in life is not consumption. To consume, you need to have produced something first. So the whole economic problem, the whole difference between us and a poor place in Africa is not that we have some great capacity to consume or to spend. It's that we need to produce. And the problem with the economy right now is that there have been many unproductive investments made and unproductive decisions made. Just take the housing market. That's a lot of wealth going into a place that's being misallocated, that's not being used in a productive way. So if we have economic problems, what we should look for is, well, what fosters production? And the number one thing that fosters production is economic freedom, which means freedom from government interference in the economy. And government interference is rampantly destroying production in the economy.
How does whether the government is building schools have anything to do with whether or not people are going to want to buy TVs?
What I don't understand the question. I mean,
Mike Huckabee, the Republican, to many Democrats, they're suggesting that if you want to stimulate the economy, particularly long term, the way that you do it is by rebuilding the infrastructure, rebuilding the commons. Let's build schools. Let's build hospitals. Let's build roads. Provide people with unemployment insurance. Provide them with food stamps. You know, how does that have anything to do with whether or not you or I are going to want to buy a new TV?
Do you agree with this policy or not?
I am frankly ambivalent about it. What I'm seeing in the stimulus package is a Band-Aid on a cancer. You know, but the cancer that I'm seeing is different from the cancer you're seeing. I mean,
exactly.
Essentially, the cancer that I'm seeing is unrestrained and unregulated laissez-faire capitalism that has so corrupted our political processes that you've got giant corporations running small entrepreneurs out of business. It's virtually impossible for a small business person to get into business in the United States today. It's a disaster. And it seems to me that if there were no government involvement, if we weren't enforcing at least some shred of antitrust legislation, for example, you'd end up with just a very small number of companies running everything, and you'd have you'd be fully in the cancer stage of capitalism, as happened at the end of the Roman Empire.
Oh, well, okay, the Roman Empire is far, far, far from a capitalist system. So, we could talk about monopoly, which we have before, but let me just say that I completely disagree with that economically in terms of how that works, and there are a lot of reasons why. While specialization across many, many, many companies is more efficient, and thus a behemoth that tries to control everything ultimately fails. And in the 60s, you had all kinds of conglomerates that were encouraged by government regulation, and most of them just completely bombed. Because you really need to specialize to succeed. In terms of the
General Electric.
In terms of laissez-faire, though, we are so far from laissez-faire. And let's start from small business. I mean, I talk to people all the time who are starting small businesses, and it's impossible for them to get a permit, from the permit board or permission to build from the zoning board. Or let's say you want to start a new
that's not the biggest problem.
In California.
Alex, you know as well as I do that 30, 40 years ago, people started, and for the first 200 years of this company, people started small businesses with the idea of it being the business that they were going to pass down to their children and grandchildren. It was going to be a family business for five generations. Nowadays, everybody is, let's get this thing going, and let's get it big enough that one of the big corporations like Microsoft doesn't swoop in and put us out of business, but instead let's make it viable enough that we can sell it off to them. Small businesses today are about, let's get it to the point where we can sell this thing because we know that if we don't, we'll be squashed like a bug.
No, that's certainly one viable thing, minus the bug idea, to create a productive business that one doesn't want to do for one's entire life, and certainly that you don't saddle your children with a business that they didn't particularly choose in the same way you shouldn't saddle your kid with being a farmer, and I wouldn't saddle my kid with being a writer and intellectual. They can do whatever they want.
Or sell it to somebody else who wants to run a small business down the road.
This happens all the time, too. The question is, what do you as an individual want to do, and what value can you create on a free market? Now, if you say, well, I want to have a small operating system business, well, I agree. What free market? Because of all of the government regulations.
Well, it's not just the government regulations, Alex. We have the commons in this country. We all breathe the same air. We all drink the same water. We're using the public road system. We have our socialized police departments, our socialized fire departments. You know, these things where our socialized roads. It's we, the people, collectively, the society, are paying for those things. And I'm assuming that you would say, no, we shouldn't be paying for any of those things.
No, that's not my view. My view is that this comes down to the purpose of the government. The government should protect individual rights from the initiation of force by other individuals and from the government. So the issue of what does the government do or not means it has to do that which is necessary to protect people's rights and nothing else. So I do not think the government should be involved in the roads, and I think that's part of the reason why the roads are a nightmare. The government absolutely should be providing police because you need a single body that enforces specific laws and that there's one of them, so you don't have mob warfare like you do in Africa and all kinds of other places. But besides being a policeman, and that includes defending our country from foreign invaders, now the government has no role. And when we the people decide things, that means they're coercing money away from me.
No, I get it. So the last time we had really radical laissez-faire capitalism in the United States was the period from around 1915, 1918 until 1929. And you had, I mean, just, you know, run amok, huge corporations, the robber barons doing their thing. It brought us the Republican Great Depression.
That's funny, because I seem to remember an amendment being passed in 1913, or several of them, that are not pro-capitalist, including, let's see, the income tax and the Federal Reserve, which had a lot to do with creating the Great Depression. So certainly the 20s, there was some element of a free market, and it was, in fact, a very productive time. But in terms of many disastrous
and
things...
And it brought about the Great Depression.
Wrong.
You can't say that the institution of the... I mean, the income tax was negligible in 1913, first of all. And you know, arguably the Fed, you know, should have... Well...
No, the Fed arguably thought it should have done things, and then it helped cause the Great Depression, and then they extended it by passing more statist protectionist tariffs like Democrats do today, and Republicans for that matter.
All righty. Well, people can read all about it over at AynRand.com, AYNRAND.org. Alex Epstein. Alex, good talking with you today.
Thanks, Tom. Good as always.
Thanks. 16 minutes past the hour. How do we best stimulate the economy?
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Well, my face may not be pretty, and my clothes are not the best, and there ain't no big shots in my family tree. But if you're wondering who it was that made this country great, you don't have to look no further, it was me. I'm the man that built the bridges, I'm the man that laid the track, I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the cars, and I laid down the cornerstone for this great land of ours.
So how do we stimulate the economy? 21 minutes past the hour, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you. Is it even an appropriate thing? And what's this meme about we're creating jobs? I mean, this whole idea of creating jobs, frankly, is a little bizarre. Speaking as somebody who has created a number of businesses that have employed probably over 200 people throughout the course of my life, certainly more than 200 people, I can tell you I never once created a job. Never once. Even though I started seven businesses that employed a couple, actually, you know, one of them I'm still on the board of, probably has, well, half that many people working for it right now. So over my lifetime, I probably created, if you want to use that metaphor, and again, I'm going to dispute it and just say created probably a couple of thousand jobs. But the reality is that I've never created a job. What I've done is I've hired people to do things that are going to make me more money than they cost me. And that's what every business person does. They don't create jobs. They use labor. You hire labor. You bring somebody in to do something that's going to generate more money ultimately than what that person costs. And this whole metaphor of creating jobs, you know, began with, frankly, with Reagan. We didn't even use that phrase back before Reagan. It was another one of Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich, one of these brilliant reframings of, oh, let's make it look like everything's coming from the wealthy, so that we can then give all these huge tax breaks to the wealthy and to justify trickle-down economics. And to forget about the fact that frankly, America was built from the bottom up. That people start businesses because they see a need and because they have determined, they put together a business plan that says, and I can hire people to work for me who are going to produce a product or a service that is going to generate more money than those people are going to cost. And if you don't pay them well, that's called exploitation. And if you do pay them well, then that's called an economy. That's called a viable business. So, A. B, here we have an economy that has been basically wrecked. And it's been wrecked in large part by, in my opinion, frankly, by war spending. If you go back and you look at the history of this country after the Civil War, what it cost us to recover from the Civil War. After the Spanish-American War, what it cost us to recover from that. After World War I, what it cost us. After World War II, what it cost us. After every war, particularly when you borrow money to fight the war, there is a period, a substantial period of recession. Why? Because unlike, by the way, when you borrow money for infrastructure like Dwight Eisenhower did or like Roosevelt did, or for that matter, borrowing money like Lyndon Johnson, he cut poverty in half with the Great Society, but he was borrowing money for the war. And here's the difference. If you borrow money and put that money into infrastructure, let's say you build a school and you borrow $1 million, you build a school. That school is going to produce 10, 20, 30, 40 million dollars worth of taxes over its lifetime because it's going to educate people. They're going to go into the workforce. They're going to pay taxes. And so that's going to, that $1 million borrowing or investment, or if you simply use tax dollars, that investment is going to produce a return. But if you take, if you borrow $1 million, or in the case of George Bush in Iraq, $1 trillion, $1 million, and you build bombs and you drop them on people, those bombs are gone. There's no added economic activity that comes as a consequence of that. None whatsoever. You know, arguably there's some small amount. The people who built the bombs, if they're built here in the United States, we're buying, actually, we ran out of ammunition last year. We started buying ammunition from Brazil and from Israel. I mean, we're buying weapon systems from other countries. We're buying parts to make missiles and smart bombs from China. So I guess arguably we're stimulating their economies. But you could argue, yeah, there's a few jobs created in the United States building these bombs. But it's a whole different thing from building infrastructure. So if you want to stimulate if there happens to be a consensus that there is some good reason to stimulate the economy, then number one, having the Fed inflate the currency is not it. The Federal Reserve, and in this regard, I agree with my guest, Alex Epstein. Having the Fed inflate the currency, you know, dropping interest rates, basically printing more money, although we don't print it anymore. We just instantly create it electronically. In fact, back in March of last year, the Bush administration stopped publishing M3, the number that tells how the extent to which they're inflating the currency, depreciating the currency, really, reducing the value of the currency. They no longer even publish it. There are some estimates that from the time Bush came into office until today, he's reduced the value, the real value of the dollar, by as much as 30%. Certainly, we've seen the price of a gallon of gasoline double. We've seen the price of gold about double. We've seen the price of oil nearly triple. These things, and you're seeing food and housing, all these things going up. Are they really going up, or is it that the dollar's going down? So you've got that, number one. And number two, this whole issue of how do you stimulate? Let's look at some serious structural stuff. We've got a country that is crumbling. Investment in infrastructure is not gratuitous stimulation. It is called building a nation. We've done this for 200 years. How about a serious discussion about that rather than, how can we pump some money in here just in time for the November elections?
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
66-303-2270. Magic of democracy. Tom Hartman radio program, listener supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, letting them know that you're listening, letting your radio stations know that you're listening, and also knowing that this program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Strange things happening out there in the world, particularly in England for some reason.
Maybe I'm crazy.
Yeah, maybe 100 woolly sheep are crazy. It formed a perfect ring on Friday. Totally baffled everybody. What's going on? So then the sheepdog comes along and scatters them, and about 3 miles away, they form another perfect circle. What's going on? Is there like some sort of magnetic field under the earth that's doing these crop circles, and now it's doing sheep circles? Or is it the aliens from the planet Xenu preparing to drop another load of pigeons? Robotic pigeons, that's what it is. Anyhow, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, drop by tomhartman.com. Rob, in Pennsylvania. Hey, Rob, what's up?
I'm doing great, Tom. Always great to listen to you.
only wanted to bring up one thing. I'm a truck driver out here. I get to think an awful lot. And the whole thing is over the last couple of years, last 10, 12 years, you know, I mean, let's create a trade agreement that jobs go to Mexico, create another trade agreement, cheaper labor over in China. American corporations have had license to be able to go all over the globe to be able to find the cheapest labor. But then they say we got to be able to compete with these other countries when we're actually competing against ourselves.
Yeah. Well, wait a minute. How so?
Well, let's face it, it's where, you know, like, I mean, if any of those people in Mexico had to be able to pay what we have to for a house up here, for food, for gas, they couldn't live. How about China? Could any of them pay for the pay, you know?
Right. So we are competing against Mexico. We are competing against the cost of Mexican labor. The problem is that it's American corporations that are offshoring those jobs. 50% of all international trade is a company doing business with itself in another country. General Motors manufacturing cars in Mexico and selling them in the United States, for example. I mean, they closed a whole bunch of factories in Flint, opened them, you know, months later in Mexico. That's not outsourcing the manufacturing. That's outsourcing labor, really. I mean, that's what it's all about. So,
yeah, but
you know,
the only thing I was going to go for was that, hello?
Yeah, you're still there.
Yes, it's a matter of, you know, the whole thing is the corporations, they go over there, they get the cheaper labor compared to what they would pay over here to be able to have that stuff put together. And guess what? You know, I mean, when they finally bring it back here, are we saving any money? I don't see where we're saving any money. The corporations are only saving the money and the labor to be able to create it. They sell it for the same price over here that they used to.
Yep, spot on, Rob. And that, as I've said, you know, David Ricardo's on profits. You didn't see Nike suddenly start getting cheaper or Phil Knight start, you know, Phil Knight's worth billions now with Nike. And it's not because as he found progressively cheaper and cheaper sources of labor, he lowered the cost of his tennis shoes. It's because the price of something is what the market will bear. The profit is whatever you can make on what the market will bear. The cost of labor is just one small piece of it, frankly, a very small piece of it. So, by the way, and I know we got a zillion callers here. I want to get back to it in just a second, but we're tonight, State of the Union. How's Bush going to deal with this? The 8 years before he came into office, we had 4.09% real GDP growth. During his 7 years, it's been 2.6%. The national debt when he came into office was $5 trillion. It's now $9 trillion. He's borrowed $4 trillion on our credit card, the names of our children and our grandchildren. The average family now is over $150,000 in debt to the government, or rather, our government is in debt on our behalf. We're in debt to the world, actually. It's not to our government, to China and to Saudi Arabia. He came into office with a $431 billion budget surplus. He now has a $734 billion budget deficit. The previous 8 years, we were creating 1.7 million jobs a year. He's been averaging 369,000 jobs a year. We've gone from 31 million Americans in poverty when Bush came into office to 36 million Americans in poverty now. From 38 million uninsured people when he came into office to 47 million uninsured people now. From a median income, a median cost for health care when Bush came into office of $6,200 per family to now $12,000 per family for health care, for health insurance. From a median household income of $49,163 when Bush came into office, it's now $48,000. It's dropped by $1,000. I mean, how's he going to spin this? Consumer debt has gone from $7 trillion to $12 trillion. The cost of college has almost doubled in 7 years. Personal savings rates have gone from 2.3% down to a negative 0.5%. Consumer credit debt has gone from $7 trillion to $12 trillion. We have gone from being the largest first world country in the world to the largest third world country in the world since Ronald Reagan came into office. And the extension of Reaganomics, these 26 years of the destruction of the American economy, has created an unprecedented number of billionaires and wiped out the middle class. What are they going to do about it? Ken in Hawaii. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was just calling to see if you had any explanation. It seems like we have a broken Congress. We have a Democratic Congress that supports stuff like Bush's economic stimulus package and his FISA bill. And if we had the roles reversed and we had a Democratic president, Republican Congress, we'd never even hear about this stuff.
Yeah, this is absolutely nuts. Bush, who, as Robert Borisage writes, has an approval rating approaching that of Idi Amin. He says, okay, only tax cuts, no spending on public works, no increase in food stamps, no strengthening of the tattered unemployment system, got to include a big package of business tax breaks, no money for states that are about to be forced to cut billions to balance their budget, largely by cutting education and Medicaid spending, deferring basic infrastructure. You can't do any of that. The Democrats all go, okay. What's going on? Yeah, I agree.
We have to fix the leadership of our Congress.
Yeah,
and that probably means replacing Reid and Nancy Pelosi.
Yes and no, Ken. Here's the problem that Nancy Pelosi has. I can't speak for the Senate. I don't know the numbers, but there are about 40. It's either 43, 46, or 48. There's more than 40 anyway of these so-called blue dog Democrats that, by and large, are Democrats who are representing largely Republican districts. If those Democrats vote in, you know, for, and this, you know, with regard to impeachment, for example, if they were to all vote to impeach George Bush, they wouldn't make it through the next election. A Democrat would take over, and Democrats would end up controlling the House of Representatives. So Nancy Pelosi has this really tough problem. She doesn't have a unified Democratic Party. She's got a coalition. She's got progressives. She's got the Yellow Dog Democrats. She's got the Blue Dog Democrats. She's got the mainstream Democrats. She's got a whole series of coalitions. It's like trying to herd cats. And there are some of these hot buttons where if she pushes it too hard, what's gonna happen is you're gonna have a whole lot of Democrats losing their seats to Republicans. I frankly think the best political strategy is to become more progressive and more aggressive and to say to these people, you know, we're going to do the right thing. We're going to, like Franklin Roosevelt, we're going to move ahead. And Jack Kennedy. But, you know, she's not pursuing that path. But on the other hand, I understand why. I disagree with it, but I understand why. And I think we have to acknowledge that unfortunate reality. Ken, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Let's see here. The Trucker in Port Orchard, Washington. Hey, Trucker, what's up?
Hello, how are you today?
Just great. What's up?
Well, focus on the Congress is about right. I would have been proposing for about 6 years that we need to dramatically increase the membership of the House of Representatives, which means a lot smaller districts, which means a lot less expense to run for office, which
yeah.
means it makes it possible to get rid of the people that aren't doing what we want them to do.
And you know, the problem is that ain't going to happen. I mean, you know, it's just not going to happen. And so instead, how about we get involved and start showing up at the local party meetings and start making some decisions about who's going to be actually running in the primaries and who's going to be representing us and that we start talking back to our elected representatives.
Well, it hasn't worked so far. Now, under the economy.
No, it hasn't worked because people haven't been doing it.
I've been doing it.
Well, yeah, you and me, but I mean, you know, it's just, frankly, it's just beginning. I mean, I think that when Bill Clinton became president, a lot of Democrats said, okay, we can go back to sleep. We can go back to making money. And they just checked out of the political process. And just in the last, basically since the war in Iraq, frankly, I think, I would submit to you, in large part, just for the last 3 years or so, have people become Democrats and progressives started to get re-involved in the political process, whereas Republicans have been involved in the political process for the better part of 30, 40 years now, ever since, basically since Roe v. Wade and a few other things, you know, and Reagan, you know, coming in and saying, okay, we're going to undo the New Deal. There's been a lot of grassroots involvement by people in the Republican Party. There hasn't been a lot of grassroots involvement by people in the Democratic Party. And that, I think, is step one. I mean, your point is well taken. Get involved locally, and you'll see a whole lot more change. Don in Arizona, thanks for the call. Don in Arizona. Hey, Don.
Tom, how are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I'm really upset at the media right now. I'm a Hillary supporter, I'll tell you that straight up, and I feel like the media is it's St. Obama, he can do nothing wrong, they're spinning it like South Carolina, yeah, he won it, but he won it because primarily the black vote, he only got about 25% of the white vote.
Yeah, that was Bill Clinton's point when he was talking about how Jesse Jackson took it, but...
And he's only gotten up as high
Don
as...
Don will pick it up on the other side.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
not. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Okay, let me finish this because I was halfway into my thought and with that last caller, and I fear it came out entirely wrong. The last caller called with basically the meme that Bill Clinton had put out just before the final vote came in on Saturday, which was the comment that, well, Jesse Jackson won the South Carolina, back when they were caucuses, won South Carolina in 84 and 88. And as by way of basically saying, oh, it's just the black vote, it doesn't matter. And the callers just came right out and said that. Said, you know, you know, why is the media making such a big deal out of the fact that Barack Obama won South Carolina when it was just African Americans voting for him and he's an African American? Give me a break. Jesse Jackson, the guy that, you know, Bill Clinton referred to, African American, Jesse Jackson did not win Iowa, a virtually all-white state. Barack Obama did. Jesse Jackson didn't come in second in New Hampshire. Barack Obama did. Jesse Jackson didn't have the Kennedy family saying things like Ted Kennedy's speech today, quote, through Barack, I believe we will move beyond the politics of fear and personal destruction and unite our country with the politics of common purpose. Jesse Jackson didn't have Caroline Kennedy saying, this man inspires me the way people say that my father inspired them. So to say that the media is all hysterical about the fact that Barack Obama won South Carolina and, you know, and that means that there's something weird about the media or that the media is anti-Hillary, I think it's nonsense. I think what's being reported is that there is a very real and genuine phenomena here, that you've got a guy who is an absolutely brilliant politician, an absolutely brilliant campaigner, may make a brilliant president, may not. Is being tested right now, and frankly, it looks like he's learning fast and he's getting better. But this is his first serious national campaign. I mean, in Illinois, he ran against Alan Keyes, a guy who didn't even live in Illinois, and who was another to take it back to the whole race issue that Bill Clinton keeps trying to take it back to. He ran against an African American, Alan Keyes, and now he has demonstrated that he can win in a state that is virtually all white, Iowa. He did it. It's not like this is something, you know, this is some unresolved. I'm telling you, when it comes to the national election, if Barack Obama is the nominee, and I would be very happy to see that happen, if Barack Obama is the nominee in the national election, the issue, sure, the Republicans, you know, you think Bill Clinton's been playing the race card. You ain't seen nothing. I mean, I'm not even remotely upset about what Bill and Hillary Clinton have been doing, particularly what Bill Clinton's been doing, because what it has been doing is it has been strengthening Barack Obama's ability to deal with challenge. Because when he takes on the Republicans, it's going to be like, you know, Bill Clinton's been sitting here with a pea shooter and all of a sudden a nuclear bomb gets dropped on him. The whole point of primaries is to learn how to deal with adversity, to learn how to deal with challenges. So, frankly, I think it's a good thing that he's getting attacked like this, that it's coming out now. But I'm telling you, you ain't seen nothing yet. But the main attack when the Republicans come after him, if he's the nominee in the fall, is not going to be about his race. They will not be that transparent. They'll just let that simmer in the background. They know that there's a racist vote out there. They've known that ever since Richard Nixon said, hey, you know, now that Lyndon Johnson Reagan actually went forward with this. And Nixon before that, he said, this was before LBJ, obviously. He said, let's do this other strategy. Let's pick up the white racist vote and make them a Republican vote. Now, the way that they will go after him is his middle name. And he's got to deal with that. And he's got to deal with it soon. And I think he can. I really think he can. I think that this guy can. I'm just, you know, incredibly impressed. Melanie in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Melanie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I was just calling to make a comment about the guy from Texas, I guess the trucker. He said that Congress has to, you know, become bigger so that more people can be represented. But if people in their thinking, everyday people, like if they change their values and the way they think, like this whole issue that race is even being brought up is really, you know, irritating me horribly. It shouldn't be in politics, period. But we, not enough people that I know even stand up for, you know, like illegal wars or, you know, somebody being homeless. I sit there and I make fun of them and they say, you know, you're a junkie. And then we always value, you know, materialistic things more than anything else. And really a lot of people aren't educated enough and they get these, I don't know, headstrong, self-defeatist kind of things going on where they're voting against, you know, inevitably themselves because they're voting against other people. They're, you know, they're voting, I don't know how to quite say it, but it's not
Congress. Well, I think
they have their part where they could, you know, just stand up and set an example because you got to start somewhere. You got to show people and try to help them change their mind.
It's never started from Congress, Melanie.
That works.
It has never started from the top down. It has always been from the bottom up.
Yeah,
every single time.
The way
we have to change ourselves.
Treat their each other and kids fighting at school. I mean, just all kinds of things. You can just see it's real bitter, and there's no. It's really dying down the unity and everything.
Yeah.
And
well, that's you know we've had 26 years of divisive politics in the United States of Lee Atwater politics of divide and conquer. It's and that's another wonderful thing. Hillary Clinton uses the word "I'll" a whole lot. John Edwards and Barack Obama use the word "we" a whole lot. I like that. Len in New York. Len, we got about half a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour.
That's way too short. you know, that's way too short. But you know,
you're burning through it.
What's that?
I said you're burning through it. Make a quick point.
I was just through Florida, and you run into way too much anybody but Hillary from wherever they're vacationing.
Yeah.
And I'd like people to recognize it's time to coalesce around Obama. Edwards should be doing the same thing if he's a patriot so we can get beyond the politics of fear.
Yeah, and I think to the extent that Edwards is not attacking Barack Obama, he's simply forwarding an agenda. What he
it's
is
not
doing,
it's an excuse. It's not good enough.
Yeah, I think he's going to be the kingmaker in the convention. We'll see. I don't know.
It has to happen sooner.
It may well be, Len. May well be. Thanks a lot for the call. 57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative
con.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Where smart people get their news.
And welcome back to our program. 6 minutes past the hour. Senator Barbara Boxer is going to be proposing legislation to allow the state of California to get an exemption or a waiver from EPA rules so that they can say, well, you know, we'd like our air to be a little cleaner. We'd like to have fewer people die from cancer and emphysema and all those other things associated with air pollution and make sure that cars are cleaner here and this sort of thing. That's basically the EPA versus California. And you would think that the 10th Amendment would back her up. It says any powers not taken by the federal government are reserved to the states and to the people. Marlo Lewis, a senior fellow with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, is on the line with us. Marlo, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be with you.
Thank you. You guys issued a press release. Senate holds hearings to complain about EPA decision denying California's CO2 waiver. And you say the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency made the right decision last month to deny California a waiver from the Clean Air Act, and then go on to say that the reason why it was the right decision is an economic one. It's good for business.
Not quite, Tom. You see, first of all, there's a lot of confusion that I think is deliberately created by people like the good senator and others. This has nothing to do with clean air. This really is all about climate policy. Carbon dioxide is not an air pollutant in the sense of something that degrades air quality or makes it harder to breathe or anything like that. In fact, carbon dioxide, just looked at in itself, is one of the things that makes green things grow. What she is attempting to do, or what the folks at California Air Resources Board are attempting to do, is set first ever carbon dioxide emission standards for automobiles. Now these are in fact, they're de facto fuel economy mandates for automobiles because practically the only way that you can reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that a car produces per mile is to increase how many miles it gets to the gallon, because when you combust a carbon-based fuel, you get carbon dioxide.
Yeah, or alternatively, to mandate more recycled carbon-based fuels, biofuels, or to use electric fuels.
Well, you could,
or
you could
hydrogen
try,
fuels,
you could
or
try
fuel
to do
cells.
It with biofuels, except that there is more and more evidence coming out every day that, for example, the leading biofuel, corn ethanol, actually produces more carbon dioxide than gasoline.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan, frankly, of corn ethanol. There are a lot more efficient ways to do that. And you know, biodiesel, I mean, if we just allow hemp production here in the United States. But that's a whole other topic.
That's a whole other topic. But you say,
CIE experts are available for comment on why the EPA decision was correct, why the decision granting the waiver would be economically devastating. This is the same argument that the car companies made when Ralph Nader was out there saying,
very
we need to have seatbelts in cars.
This is a very new argument, Tom, and the argument is this, that once you regulate carbon dioxide under the Clean Air Act, which is what would happen if California were granted the waiver, that it would require the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate CO2 from all kinds of sources that have nothing to do with automobiles. There's a part of the Clean Air Act called the Prevention of Significant Deterioration Program, and this applies to stationary sources, buildings, factories, farms. The cutoff or the threshold for regulating a pollutant under this program is 250 tons a year. Now, that may sound like a lot when you're dealing with sulfur dioxide or nitrous oxide or something that contributes to smog or particulates, okay? But when you're dealing with carbon dioxide, any ordinary office building like the one that you're sitting in right now would have to be regulated.
Then why not let the people? Why not let
it?
The good citizens? I get it. Why not let the good citizens of California deal with this themselves?
Because it would apply to the entire country. If this is a case in which California would be making the rest of the country a regulatory colony of California, and the question that needs to be asked is whether Congress, back in 1970,
Marlo, I don't understand what you're saying.
Well, then let me clarify.
California getting a waiver so that California can create California standards. How is that going to apply to the rest of the country, other than that the other, you know, if people want to manufacture products to sell in California, they're going to have to manufacture them to California standards?
No, that's the smokescreen, Tom. The reality is that the Prevention of Significant Deterioration Program, which would apply to buildings, which have nothing to do with the provision in the Clean Air Act under which California was applying for the waiver, the buildings would be everywhere, all over the country, farms all over the country, little mom-and-pop factories all over the country. They'd have to get a permit in order to start the business. If they wanted to modify the business in any way, expand it, they would have to get a permit. Those permits can take more than a year to get. They can cost more than $1 million per entity. The determination as to whether or not a permit for one of these buildings or facilities would be granted has to be done on a case-by-case business. What this would do would so flood the California Air Resources Board and every other state environmental agency with permit applications, it would shut down environmental enforcement all over the country. It would be not only economic chaos, but regulatory chaos. And I'm not making this up. This is the way the Clean Air Act is written, but that's why EPA all of a sudden is saying, whoops, we better not pull this trigger because we will be opening a Pandora's box of gigantic proportions.
At the bottom line, the ultimate bottom line of this is, are we going to begin regulating carbon dioxide? Are we going to begin to stop the production of carbon dioxide in the United States? I mean, here we are, 5% of the world's population. We're producing probably a quarter of the world's carbon dioxide right now.
That's right, and over a quarter of the world's gross domestic product.
And there's a connection. Certainly there is, ultimately we're going to have to. And you could argue that we really should have continued with Jimmy Carter back in the day when he said, we will import no more. Oil into the United States than we did in 1978, that by the year 2000, 20% of our electricity will be produced by solar energy. I mean, it is possible for us to still have a large chunk of the world's GDP and not be producing a large chunk of the world's carbon dioxide. Why not begin going down that road?
Well, the thing is, there was a reason why Jimmy Carter was not able to to plan the future the way he thought.
He actually got the legislation passed. He gave birth to the solar power industry.
I know, but, you know, he...
It was Reagan who took it apart.
Smart people predicted but that by the year 2000, which is already 8 years ago, the United States would be getting 20% of its energy from solar power. And today we get less than half of 1%
because
from solar and wind.
Because
combined.
Reagan came in and took Carter's solar panels off the roof of the White House.
No, it's political will cannot overturn economic reality. I mean, that was the problem. It wasn't that we had
political will has in many cases defined economic reality. Economic reality,
solar and wind are too damn expensive.
There is no objective and economic reality that exists in a separate universe out there, Marlo. Economic reality exists within the context
solar
of
power works great when the sun is shining, but people need electricity at night. Wind turbines generate electricity when the wind is blowing, but it doesn't always blow. Sometimes on the hottest days, the hottest days are hottest because the wind isn't blowing, and that's exactly
what people storage
think,
systems. I mean,
that they can get all this extra electricity from wind.
So you develop storage systems, you develop alternative systems, you develop complex systems.
That's easier said than done. People have been trying to find ways to store electricity for over a century.
And building the nuclear bomb was easier said than done, but government decided to do that. I mean, if for better or for worse, the fact of the matter is that if we decide that we're going to... No, I'm saying that we need a Manhattan Project-style effort to stop global warming because it's capable of ending civilization.
Can I tell you what the big difference is, Tom, is that when you're building a nuclear bomb, you only have to satisfy the requirements of the military. When you're trying to put a man on the moon, it's basically a geopolitical objective, but when you're trying to design a new energy technology, you have to satisfy millions and millions of customers who are free to spend their money or not, and also thousands and thousands of investors.
So let's be offering the kinds of tax breaks and incentives that Jimmy Carter was doing that were causing that to happen all over the country. You travel around this country right now looking at used homes, you'll find houses that were built in the late 70s and early 80s that are very, very efficient, highly solar, simply because he was offering those credits. Reagan did away with those credits, and they didn't exist for another 30 years. Nobody was building those kind of houses. We could, if we had followed Carter's lead, be 20% solar right now.
Well, Tom, you and I will just have to disagree on that little bit of history there, right?
Okay, all righty. Marlo Lewis, you can read all about it over the Competitive Enterprise Institute's website, cei.org. He's a senior fellow with the CEI. Marlo, thanks for dropping
by.
You're
welcome, Tom.
Good talking.
Thanks a lot.
Bye. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
Demand is up, supplies are down. What I want is light, crude and brown. I crave oil.
Oh, George.
To get my kicks, attack the rack to get my fix. I love oil, oh, every ounce. Nuclear, I can't pronounce. When my twins go out for fun, I say don't drive, take Air Force One. Oh, we can't conserve it, we are just way too spoiled. Oh, yeah. Globe is heating up, you know it's starting to boil. Gonna have to face it, we're addicted to oil. I saw the signs, but
yeah,
I'm
you know, even George Bush has acknowledged this. I mean, that's the amazing thing. That even Bush has come out and said, yeah, there's addiction to oil, and we've got to do something about it. And then he proposes absolutely nothing to do about it, but nonetheless, he says, yeah, it's there, it's real. Jimmy Carter, as I said, Jimmy Carter just laid this stuff out and said, you know, this is a real problem. This is a real crisis, and we really and truly need to do something about it. It's absolutely urgent that we do so. This is Jimmy Carter back in 1979.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And, of course, Reagan came into office with huge money from the oil lobby, reversed all of Carter's policies, and I would argue that that led directly to our to the Iraq War, you know, to Bush Sr.'s involvement in the Middle East, and arguably directly to 9/11. You know, they wouldn't be after us if we weren't there. It's not like we're being attacked by Iceland or something. And Carter also talked about solar power.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
And he could have done it. And this, you know, and the question, well, should government play some kind of role in all this? You know, after all, we're all independent here in America, aren't we? You know, great entrepreneurs. John Gray wrote this thing back in 2004. Joe Republican, John Gray of Cincinnati, Ohio. Joe gets up at 6 a.m. and fills his coffee pot with water to prepare his morning coffee. The water is clean and good because some tree-hugging liberal fought for minimum water quality standards. With his first swallow of coffee, he takes his daily medication. His medications are safe to take because some stupid commie liberal fought for their safety and that they work as advertised. All the $10 of Joe's medications are paid for by his employer's medical plan because some liberal union workers fought their employers for paid medical insurance, and now Joe gets it too. He prepares his morning breakfast, bacon and eggs. Joe's bacon is safe to eat because some girly man liberal fought for laws to regulate the meatpacking industry. In morning shower, Joe reaches for his shampoo with bottles properly labeled with each ingredient and its total amount because some crybaby liberal fought for his right to know what he's putting on his body and how much it contained. Joe dresses, walks outside, and takes a deep breath. The air he breathes is clean because some environmentalist wacko liberal fought for laws to stop industries from polluting our air. He walks to the subway station for his government-subsidized ride to work. Saves him considerable money in parking and transportation fees because some fancy-pants liberal fought for affordable public transportation, which gives everyone the opportunity to contribute to society. Joe begins his workday. He's got a good job with excellent pay, medical benefits, retirement, paid holidays, and vacation because some lazy liberal union members fought and died for these working standards. Joe's employer pays these standards because Joe's employer doesn't want his employees to call in the union. If he's hurt on the job or becomes unemployed, he'll get a workers' compensation or unemployment check because some stupid liberal didn't think he should lose his home just because of a temporary misfortune. It's noontime. He needs to go to the bank so he can pay some bills. His deposit is federally insured by the FSLIC because some godless liberal wanted to protect Joe's money from unscrupulous bankers who ruined the banking system during the Republican Great Depression. Joe has to pay his Fannie Mae underwritten mortgage and his below-market federal student loan because some elitist liberal decided that Joe and the government itself, all of us, would be better off if he was educated and earned more money over his lifetime. After work this evening, he's going to visit his dad in his home in the country, farm in the country. He gets in his car for the drive. His car is among the safest in the world because some America-hating liberal, fought for car safety standards. He arrives at his boyhood home, third generation to live in a house financed by the Farmers Home Administration because bankers didn't want to give rural loans. Home didn't have electricity until some big government liberal stuck his nose in where it didn't belong and demanded rural electrification. Joe's happy to see his dad, who's now retired and lives on Social Security, a union pension, because some wine-drinking, cheese-eating liberal made sure he could take care of himself so Joe wouldn't have to. Joe gets back in his car for the ride home and turns on the talk radio show. Radio host keeps saying, liberals are bad, conservatives are good. Doesn't mention that his beloved Republicans had fought against every single protection and benefit Joe enjoyed throughout the day. Joe agrees. He says, we don't need these big government liberals ruining our lives. After all, I'm a self-made man. Everyone who believes... who believes everyone should take care of themselves just like I have. Yeah. And Joe got a free public education, and his home is protected by a socialist fire department, and he's safe because of the socialist police department, and he's driving on the socialist roads. Amazing. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Ask the girl to go driving with me. See the country in my head.
34 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Our blog over at Air America, airamerica.com, the Tom Hartman page. And tomhartman.com will get you to our website, to our chat room. And a number of people have called in and said, John Gray, who wrote, you know, where is that thing? That Joe Republican thing that you were just reading. And Louise will be posting it on the homepage of our website at tomhartman.com in today's blog, along with a link to the original piece that John Gray wrote back in 2004 so that he gets appropriate credit for it as well. Steve in California. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. I wanted to comment about your guest this morning. I worked in solar energy development and research, photovoltaic energy research, for a major oil company
mm-hmm.
back in the later years of Carter and then well into the Reagan years.
Right.
Now, when Reagan came in, the whole attitude for this oil company towards solar just changed radically. It turned on a dime. And we started developing, instead of solar systems for commercial use,
right.
We started developing solar panels for killer satellites in space.
For military use. Yeah, because Reagan was spent $1 trillion on Star Wars.
For Star Wars, right. And this company was getting funded by the Air Force to do this. Well, the staff that was scientists that were working on this was not the reason we signed on. That was not the reason. And we started basically complaining, and one day the vice president in charge of the project called us all together and said, I want you to understand we're not here to develop solar energy. We are here to develop the patents so we can control licensing of solar energy. Hmm. And that is a big difference.
Yeah, it is. It's a way of saying we're here to make money, period, end of discussion.
Well, they were
which is the first mandate of any company, but go ahead.
Well, we are here to make sure that if it's ever commercially viable, we will be in control of how it's manufactured and marketed. That's what they were telling us.
Yeah.
If you look at all of our energy options in America, it's always, well, you can pick one from column A or one from column B. And they always own both column A and B.
Yeah.
And there's the stifling,
And this was an oil company you were working for?
Chevron in Richmond, California.
Interesting.
How's that?
Yeah. Well, you know, the largest seller of solar panels in the world right now is British Petroleum.
Yeah, well, Chevron was really upset because ARCO had made some real inroads into development.
Mm.
And, you know, oil companies are very competitive amongst themselves.
Yeah.
They want no competition from anybody outside, but amongst themselves they're very competitive. And Chevron wanted to catch up with what ARCO was doing.
There you go. Interesting.
So
Steve,
that's a reality. I could name names, but what the hell? That's all. That's
yeah.
not worth
Steve, it. Thanks a lot for the background and for the interesting story.
Yeah, it
much appreciated.
Yeah.
And thanks for listening to Green 960 there in San Francisco. Bob in Arlington Heights, Illinois. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
How are you doing, Tom? Listen to you all the time. I listen to you like on Nova AM radio in the morning and usually mm-hmm. a replay in the afternoon on Air America Radio 820 and AM in Chicago. Anyway,
yeah.
I wanted to bring up two points, and the second one I wanted to ask your opinion on. The first point, I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but I think it's perfect time, and Dennis Kucinich is going to be going on the floor later this afternoon, and he's going to be bringing up over 50 articles of impeachment against George W. Bush, and
yeah,
we need to
perfect counterpoint to the State of the Union address.
Oh, you bet. We need to call our media, which I'm starting right now, and call Congress and tell them how much we really, really need this to happen. We need to support Dennis in this.
Yeah, and call your members of Congress and ask them to sign on to co-sign those.
Yes, sir. You got it. You're right. Another thing is, I wanted to ask your opinion. The way I understand it, at the convention, delegates from various states go there, and they put the vote in for the candidate that won in that state. Now, that's kind of just to put it simple, but then I'm aware of that there are super delegates that go there, too.
Yeah, hang on. Let me back you up a little bit. Our primary system is not winner-take-all. So when you say, for example, Barack Obama won in South Carolina, he didn't take all of the delegates from South Carolina. He took some. Hillary took some. John Edwards took some. Same thing with New Hampshire. Same thing with, you know, in every state. So it's not quite the horse race that it would be with, for example, electoral votes in the states towards the presidency.
They have to get a certain number of delegates, but this is proportional representation in all these cases rather than first past the post, winner take all. And so
you're right, just, but just I also, I'm aware that the superdelegates can go in there and override everything. And you know,
well, they can't override anything. They simply have a vote.
Right. And
but there's a whole bunch of them. There's like 700 and something of them.
Right, so they can really change everything around depending on who their best interest is for.
Right, they're the swing votes. And these and the superdelegates are every federally elected Democrat. In other words, every Democratic member of the House, every Democratic member of the Senate, and I believe all of the Democratic governors as well are superdelegates, as well as the head of the party. So Howard Dean would be. I don't know if Susie Turnbull, number two, is or not. And there's a few other folks who are superdelegates. But, yeah, I mean, and the superdelegates all get to vote, too. And some of them have pre-committed their votes, but they can always change.
Sure.
But you're right. They are the big wild card. And because of the superdelegates, frankly, I don't think after Super Tuesday, unless there's an absolute landslide for either Obama or Hillary, and I don't see either happening. I think this is going to continue to be a very competitive race, particularly between those two. I think that after Super Tuesday, after February 5th, we're still going to be trying to figure out who's going to be the Democratic nominee. And frankly, I think the Republicans, it's going to come down to McCain and Romney, and I think the Republicans are still going to be battling that one out, too. I would never underestimate Mitt Romney. Here's a guy who was a Mormon Republican who won a Catholic Democratic state, Massachusetts, as governor. Although, as Carl Wolfson, our morning host here on KPOJ, pointed out this morning, He did not run for re-election because he would not have been re-elected. As soon as he ran as a liberal, and as soon as he was elected, he started running for president. He became a radical conservative, and Massachusetts turned against him. But the guy has got more money than God. He's got between $250 and $400 million. He's already dropped something like $30-40 million of his own money into this thing. You're going to have, if he ends up the candidate and then Bloomberg gets in, you're going to have two basically self-financed candidates running with just mind-boggling amounts of money. And it's going to be wild. I'm telling you, this fall is going to be absolutely wild. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. Doreen in New York City. Hey, listening on WWRL. Hey, Doreen, what's up?
How are you, Tom? Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Enjoy your show. I'm going to speak about what your last caller spoke about, Dennis Kucinich presenting the articles of impeachment with regard to our President George Bush. And I saw on YouTube today, on C-SPAN, him, I guess, making his first part of his presentation. It was about a minute long.
This was
and
today?
And then Kucinich.
This was today?
Today, on the House floor.
Right, okay.
And then whoever posted it, fast forwarded it because, you know, there's just nothing going on. He did his presentation, and then they fast forwarded it. And then a representative from Florida came up and asked him to withdraw his statement that it violated House rules. And then the video ends. So I was wondering if you knew what he did that was objectionable to House rules by presenting that one-minute speech.
I don't, Doreen. I honestly don't. I will see if I can track that down, though, over the next 15 or 20 minutes, and maybe in the next hour we can come up with it. I'm sorry. I right off the top of my head, don't know. Steve in Lake Oswego, Oregon. Hey, listening to KPOJ. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A couple of quick points about the person who called before about nuclear power and global warming.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, one of the things that have actually come across our national news is that we may have to close 26 nuclear power plants in our southeast because of the lack of water to cool the plants.
That's right. Yeah. Nuclear power plants don't just use nuclear fuel, which itself is a limited resource, far more limited, frankly, than fossil fuels. They also use mind-boggling amounts of water.
Okay, now here's something our national media are not covering that you actually have to read the foreign presses to hear about. That some months ago there was a serious problem. I can't remember whether it was a Swiss or a Swedish nuclear plant that required an extended shutdown, and also that many of the European power plants may have to shut down because the waters, you know, the rivers and everything else are warming up.
Are getting too warm, yeah.
Too warm to cool the plants according to the way they were designed and built.
That's so, right. This is a problem that they already have with at least one French nuclear power plant. I believe there's a UK one. I've seen those stories, Steve. Yeah, nuclear power is absolutely no answer to this thing. It's not at all. Dane in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Dane, we're coming up against a break here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just had some comments about Marlo Lewis.
and he suggested that California's new requirements would quote unquote make the rest of the U.S. regulatory colonies of California, and I find that almost impossible to believe, because it suggests that California would require that the producers of any product that comes into California must adhere to the new California rule. For instance, yeah. Widget producers in New York would have to fall under the California requirement.
Yeah, see, it didn't make sense to me either, and we're going to try and get Barbara Boxer on the program a little later on in the week and talk specifically about this, because with regard to car emission standards and things, I mean, you know, certainly there have been car manufacturers that for a long time have been making cars to California standards and things like that. California has led the nation. It used to be Pennsylvania with food, for example. If you wanted to have a food product, it always said certified by the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture because they had the tightest national standards. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
What about now? What about today? What if you're making me all that I was meant to be? What if I never went?
9.5 minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU, 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Ellen Ratner on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
I'm at the Senate today, and it's very interesting. Senator Reid is talking about how good the president is at scaring the American people, but not very good at following up on any kind of real agenda. And the senator really expects that the Pfizer will expire. That's what he told a bunch of us today. He also said that they've had 36 separate votes in Iraq and that they have had a very, very hard time getting anything because of the 60 votes necessary. He also said he gave a real kudos today to Chuck Hagel, and he said he gave up his career in politics based on principle. So
yeah, well,
unless he's gonna, is really pushing before tonight.
Yeah, unless he's going to run for vice president with Mr. Bloomberg. We'll see. By the way, I understand that we're down to the point now, since Jay Rockefeller has now said that he'll vote no on cloture for the FISA bill, that we only need three more. This what I'm getting from the Daily Kos. By Carper, Inouye, Johnson, Landrieu, McCaskill, Mikulski, Nelson of Florida, Nelson of Nebraska, Pryor, and Salazar are essentially the swing votes. Those are all the Democratic senators.
And you know something, I got to tell you, I've been
we need to be calling.
McCaskill. I've talked to her about other stuff. To me, this woman is not a progressive in any way, shape, or form. And a lot of progressives gave her money, and I just think it's shameful.
Yeah. Well, nonetheless, that's the list. These are the senators. We need to get three of these senators, of this group of senators, to change their vote on FISA to say, no, we're not going to just wink and nod when the laws are broken. And that's by Carper, Inouye, Johnson, Landrieu, McCaskill, Mikulski, Nelson, Pryor, and Salazar. And if you live in a state and you are represented by one of these people, go to callcongress.org. There's the toll-free phone numbers for Congress, and call your senator and say no on immunity and FISA.
Okay. We are, as I said, here at the Senate today, and we will be in Statuary Hall very, very shortly. You can follow us tonight. We're going to actually be what we call twittering the State of the Union, and also right afterwards doing an awful lot of interviews, both from Republicans and Democrats. So you can check that out. But also, what we're going to see tonight in the president's speech is going to be he's going to hit very, very heavy on earmarks. He's going to try and look like the fiscal conservative that he's not. In fact, it turns out when you look at all the spending he's done $1.6 trillion he has added to the deficit since he's been president. He is also going to his budget, which is going to be released next Monday, is not going to fully fund the war. In fact, he's going to do incremental bridge funding of $70 to $80 billion. That's about half of the annual spending in the war. and that he is, and of course, he's going to leave this all for the next president.
Right.
Not a very pretty picture.
Yeah, so if the next president wants to continue the occupation for even one more day, they're going to have to say, okay, we need to get money here for this occupation. By the way, I would say the war, you know, ended when we took down Iraq's government. That's the definition of the end of a war. We executed Saddam. We seized his government. We seized the country. We destroyed their army. We won the war. George Bush was right when he was on the Abraham Lincoln. Then began the occupation, and we've been screwing up the occupation for 5 years, if I may.
Put a fine point
on language. I just don't like referring to it as a war. It's an occupation.
But I do want to underline one thing, and that is that Senator Reid is really pretty determined that FISA is going to just die an untimely death on February 1st, and that is great news for all of us.
Yeah, you mean he thinks that he's got his 40 votes?
Well, I think he thinks he does, and I think he's very hopeful about it.
Yeah. Well, I would still
wait for Senator Reid. I mean,
yeah.
More
yeah.
power to him.
Yeah. Yeah. Amen. I would still be calling my senators, but
oh, absolutely. No. It still needs to be an all-court press.
Yep. Yep. So what else is going on in Washington,
okay,
D.C.?
Okay. The other big news in town is that first of all, let me just tell you, Kansas Governor Sebelius is going to be giving the response. They think that she has done a lot for a red state. She's sort of the poster person for a red state that has become blue and actually doing quite a bit. There's a lot of talk around here that they could pick up the necessary votes in the next election in the Senate to break that 60 votes. So people are very, very hopeful about that. And I got to also tell you, it's really interesting to talk to a lot of people who were previously uncommitted around whether they were going to go to Clinton, Obama, and have not been terribly very pleased with what happened in South Carolina this weekend with the former president. And it'll be very interesting to see how this turns out in the next 2 weeks here.
Yeah, indeed it will. And Ted Kennedy and Caroline Kennedy and I guess Patrick Kennedy now coming out and endorsing Barack Obama.
That's right.
He is JFK.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens at State of the Union tonight and how these people react to each other. That, as I said to a senator, boy, would I love to be a fly on the wall in the cloakroom, the Senate cloakroom, when these guys encounter each other.
Well, and one of the major things that Bush has to do with the State of the Union is set up a political environment that will help get a Republican elected as president. And if he's betting that it's going to be John McCain, I'm guessing he's going to be pushing the McCain button issues. Do you think that there's a political calculus in there? Do you think that he's got?
Well, I think that there is, and frankly, he owes it to McCain. But there's a lot of talk in New York about McCain being joined, perhaps, by Bloomberg.
Oh, that's interesting.
A lot of talk. I spent yesterday with some major movers and shakers in the New York political scene, and that's what they're all talking about.
So Bloomberg
would
be
elected officials talking.
His vice presidential candidate would be Bloomberg. Wow.
That would certainly move things.
Yeah, that would be very difficult for any Democrat to take down because they'd have unlimited resources. Bloomberg's got $1 billion. Yeah. I mean, and he said anybody who dies rich is crazy. Ellen Ratner, TalkReadyNews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thanks.
57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, tonight is going to be the State of the Union address. Bill in Portland, Maine, over at the Daily Kos suggests this is how it's going to go. He's going to say, folks, it's been a real blast raping and pillaging this great country and taking away your civil liberties for 8 years. Sure was fun landing on that aircraft carrier. Kind of sucks about Katrina. Oh, and those 935 lies my administration told before we invaded Iraq, they weren't lies at all. I was just joking. I'm a joker, see? Bringing a little levitation to you folks. And Terry Schiavo, I'd do it all over again for you, darling. Now get out there and spend those rebate checks when they arrive in June or August or whenever. Make sure you send a thank you card to China since their lenderization is making possible your spenderosity. Yeah. It's actually a pretty good one. The last night, 60 Minutes had a piece, did a program where they were laying out, they were interviewing the guy who was responsible for both interrogating and supervising Saddam Hussein. And there was one point where I was actually shouting at the television. Louise and I are sitting in bed watching this thing. And Scott Pelley, as I recall, was the guy doing the interviewing. And, yeah, Scott Pelley. And he's talking to George Pirro, who's the guy who was there with Saddam. And he said the absolutely most amazing thing. He basically was repeating this Republican lie. Let me just get the absolute quote here from Pelley. Because this is just, you know, Bob Perry's writing about this over on Common Dreams and at consortiumnews.com. He says, for a man who drew America into two wars and countless military engagements, we never knew what Saddam Hussein was thinking. Why did he choose war with the United States? And, you know, you've heard me on many times play this clip of George Bush saying that we gave Saddam a chance to bring in the inspectors, and he threw the inspectors out, and therefore we had to invade. And that's, in fact, let me just share this with you. The GOP, the Republican Party, has been trying to completely rewrite history and convince the world, and there's a great YouTube about this, I'm going to share actually from some of the clips from this, convince the world that we were forced to invade Iraq after Saddam would not let the UN inspectors back in. I mean, this is the meme that the GOP, the Bush administration, have been pushing, and pushing hard for the last 3 or 4 years. And it's a plain old flat-out lie. First of all, let's go back to before Resolution 1441 was passed, which said, Saddam, you must let inspectors in. Here's Joe Lieberman being interviewed on television.
We're thinking about options about how to make this work.
This is January 14th, 2002.
I just hope he doesn't accept inspectors.
Because if he does, the UN inspectors...
We'll be right back into a cat and mouse game indefinitely.
There they are saying, well, hopefully he won't get inspectors. So it starts in 2003. Here's Bush, and he's sitting right next to Kofi Annan.
Yes, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely.
Now, let me back this up a little bit and start this over again, because this is Bush on July 17th, 2003. Okay, this is 4 months after the invasion. This is after the invasion.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let him in.
If you're saying, let's turn back the
clock. Now, which is just a complete lie. Saddam not only let the inspectors in, he gave them all kinds of chances to run all over the place, all over Iraq, and do anything they want, as I'll play some audio from Hans Blix. But here's Mitt Romney a few weeks ago in one of the Republican debates laying this out, following on the tail end of this George Bush clip.
We gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in.
And now to Mitt Romney.
If you're saying, let's turn back the clock, and Saddam Hussein had opened up his country to IAEA inspectors, and they'd come in, and they'd found that there were no weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, well, that was on June 5th, by the way, 2007. And, in fact, IAEA inspectors were allowed back into Iraq. Again, this is great YouTube. In December of 2002, we'll post this on our website, you can see it, followed by the destruction of the Al-Samud missiles in 2003. We not only had inspectors in there, we found the last remnants of his missile system, and we were destroying
them. With the destruction of the Al-Samud missiles continuing, the UN weapons inspectors set off again to supervise the process.
This is March 2nd, 2003. This is a month before the invasion. This is video from the BBC reporting from Iraq.
The destruction of the missiles is being seen in some quarters as Iraq's most serious step towards disarmament in 4 years. The missiles are only being glimpsed on their way to be destroyed because Iraqi officials say pictures of their actual elimination would be too painful for Iraqis to witness. But the process itself may not continue if, as reported, American and British pilots are stepping up their attacks inside Iraq's no-fly zones. These reported attacks are seen in Baghdad as a prelude to war, adding to concerns that Washington is preparing to bypass the United Nations in its drive towards war.
And now this is what we know from the Downing Street memo, is that Bush and Blair had already planned to go to war no matter what, even though the inspectors were finding nothing. In fact, they were destroying the missiles. Here's bulldozers coming in to crush these missiles on videotape, same
crude
day.
Crude tools for a very sensitive job. These earth movers plowed into Al-Taji base north of Baghdad today to smash up more of Iraq's banned Al-Samud missiles. Six were expected to be destroyed. That leaves more than 90 missiles to go. The UN calls this a significant step in the disarmament of Iraq. But the mathematics of missiles doesn't satisfy in London and Washington, and Iraq today redoubled its effort to persuade the world it's cooperating and to head off war.
If war takes place, if war happens, it's not because Iraq has not done all it could.
This is the presidential advisor to the number two guy, or the Saddam Hussein's right-hand man, essentially, speaking at the UN.
Regarding disarmament, Iraq is doing all it could possibly do.
But the Americans call this a game of deception. Iraq has also said it will submit a report to the inspectors on the amounts of anthrax and VX nerve agent, which it says were destroyed 11 years ago after the first Gulf War.
So now we, you know, jump back to March 7th, 2003. Now here we are in 2003. This is from the McNeil-Larry report.
The inspector's presentations to the UN Security Council, Ray Suarez reports.
In his third update to the Security Council this year, the chief weapons inspector, Hans Blix, said his team has faced relatively few difficulties gaining access to Iraqi sites, and he reported recent progress in the area of monitoring Iraq by air.
At this juncture, we are able to perform professional, no-notice inspections all over Iraq and to increase aerial surveillance.
And then suddenly Bush orders everyone out of Iraq.
In Iraq, Monday,
this March 17th, 2003.
It was just another day for the weapons inspectors of the United Nations. For nearly 4 months, they've examined hundreds of sites across Iraq for the weapons whose existence Britain and the United States say justifies war. Clearly, there's much still to do, but all the signs are that their work will soon be curtailed. They've been advised by the Americans to leave, and although no decision has been taken, it can only be a matter of time before they're withdrawn.
The UN ordered all its employees to leave Iraq today amid signs of the looming conflict. The agency has some 300 people in the country, including weapons inspectors and relief workers. Secretary General Annan, in announcing they would be withdrawn, said those who wanted to avoid war were disappointed and frustrated.
In the sense that we are not able to do it peacefully, obviously it's a disappointment and a sad day for everybody. War is always a catastrophe. It leads to major human tragedy. Lots of people are going to be uprooted, displaced from their homes, and nobody wanted that.
The U.S. diplomatic window on Iraq was formally shut down this morning by Secretary of State Colin Powell. He spoke to reporters in Washington after the U.S., Britain, and Spain pulled a proposed resolution at the U.N. Here are some excerpts.
And then he goes on with the Colin Powell resolution. You know, Hans Blix came right out and said, we found nothing. I mean, there's nothing here. And it looks like there is for sure nothing here. And you give us another 2 or 3 months, we'll prove to you there's nothing here. And Bush pulled out the inspectors. And then he goes on and says, but Saddam wouldn't let the inspectors in, and therefore we had to invade. And now you've got Mitt Romney running around repeating this. How bizarre is this world anyway? 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Because I'll be my old self when I wake in the morning. Oh, but tonight's still.
So here we have. Number one, Resolution 1441, UN Security Council Resolution 1441, required a vote of the Security Council before the commencement of hostilities. It was right in there, as I recall, is Article 7 of it. And that never happened. Our invasion of Iraq was illegal. 6 months after the invasion, the United Nations passed a resolution at the urging of the United States, retroactively, essentially forgiving the United States for breaking international law by invading Iraq. Because we violated 1441. So, number one, we went against the UN. Number two, the Senate resolution that Hillary Clinton and John Edwards were condemned for voting for said that the only way that Bush could use force against Iraq is if he certified in writing to the Senate within 60 days of the commencement of hostilities that there was clear evidence that Saddam Hussein was linked to 9/11. That Saddam himself was linked somehow to the events of 9/11. And in fact, about a month and a half later, 45, 50 days later, George W. Bush did write a letter. You can find it over at the WhiteHouse.gov website. Wrote a letter to Congress saying, I certify, I swear, that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11. Now, at the same time, we have, since then, had Bush come out and say, no, I don't think Saddam had anything to do with 9/11. I mean, at what point do you say, you know, it's out of control? I mean, it's like, at what point do you say, hang on just a second here, I've got the... Yeah, I can't find it. Anyway, here, this is, again, I want you to hear this.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in. And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power, along with other nations, so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
So here's Bush, you know, lying. He's sitting next to Kofi Annan when he's doing it. You wonder, and who is there through the whole thing. And you wonder, you know, is he lying or is he delusional? And then Scott Pelley last night on 60 Minutes, and this is, you know, again, this is the second part of the quote. This is where I was really yelling at the TV. Then he says, as the U.S. marched towards war and we began massing troops on its border, why didn't he stop it then? And say, look, I have no weapons of mass destruction. I mean, how could he have wanted his country to be invaded? Here's a 60 Minutes correspondent, a 60 Minutes reporter, asking this as if it was a legitimate question, when what was actually going on in Iraq at that time was that the weapons inspectors had free and unfettered access to the entire country. They were roaming around all over the place. As Hans Blix said, you know, there were no impediments. They were showing up, catching people sound asleep. Nobody was following them around. Nobody was stopping them. The Saddam's government itself, the inspectors had found some missiles that they said were 3.5 feet longer than they were supposed to be, and they destroyed them. And that was the only thing they could find, was the missiles. I mean, it was obvious to pretty much everybody in the world that there was nothing there. It just blows my mind. In the Republican debates the other night, on three different occasions, John McCain said, we believed, you know, we voted for the war, and the Democrats voted for the war, too. First of all, in the House of Representatives, the majority of Democrats voted against the resolution giving Bush the authority to go into Iraq if he could prove that Iraq had something to do with 9/11. It was in the Senate that it was the majority of the Democrats. So it wasn't the majority of Democrats numerically. It was the minority of Democrats who voted for it. Number one. And number two, it wasn't to invade Iraq to protect the United States or to stop weapons of mass destruction. That Senate resolution had to do with 9/11, which is why everybody was afraid not to vote in favor of it in the Senate, or at least by everybody, Hillary Clinton and John Edwards anyway. You know, why that political calculus was being played out. And yet you have Mitt Romney out here saying, well, if he'd let the inspectors in, then we could have done this. Here's Hans Blix after the invasion began.
You know, in the Middle Ages, when people were convinced there were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
But there was no evidence. In fact, all of the evidence was that there was nothing there. There was no there there. There were no weapons there. We knew that before we invaded. So why did we invade?
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
1999, George Bush saying, if he becomes president, he's going to invade Iraq to get political capital, to get Republicans elected, to get his legislative agenda passed. And he did, and he did. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Why don't we liberate these United States? We're the ones who need it worse. Let the rest of the world help us for change, and let's rebuild America first. Our highways and bridges are falling apart. Who's blessed and who has been cursed?
You tell them, Merle.
There's things to be done all over the world, but let's rebuild America first.
Hey, give us a call on the program comment line, whether you agree, disagree, just want to sound off, give us a piece of your mind. Comment line 202-536-5306. Keep it under 30 seconds, and your comment might just make it on the air. You'll find that on the contact link over at our page on our website at 866, excuse me, at tomhartman.com. So, let's see. George Bush, this was about 2 months ago, he was asked in a press conference, did Iraq have it? Now, this is after, keep in mind, he wrote a letter to Congress justifying the invasion of Iraq, saying that that Iraq and Saddam Hussein were directly involved with 9/11.
What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing.
So, in Brattleboro, Vermont, the town is going to be voting on whether or not Bush and Cheney should be indicted and arrested for war crimes, perjury, or obstruction of justice if they ever step foot in Vermont. The good citizens of Vermont will be voting on this shortly. Interesting. Jim in New York. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to thank you for that summation of the history of the lies about not allowing inspectors in.
Yeah, one of many lies. I mean, this is the most conspicuous, obvious, and I was just boggled when Scott Pelley said that last week.
I mean, that's the other reason why I called, just to say I had the same reaction when I was watching television. When he said that, I was like, but wait a minute. Why are you saying that this? He said, well, why was Saddam ready to go to war with the United States? It's because Saddam had already conceded to everything that we asked for.
Right. And
he
was going
out. We were going to go to war because he did everything we asked for.
He was desperately begging us not to attack him. In fact, he even said that his plan to go to selling his oil to us in euros instead of dollars, he was going to flip back and go just to dollars. I mean, you know, he was trying everything he could to avoid being attacked.
Yeah, and it boggles the mind how we would just go on there and just perpetuate this lie like that. It was amazing to see.
Yeah, I agree. It was mind-boggling. Thanks a lot for the call, Jim. I appreciate it. Chris in Venetia, California. Hey, Chris.
Tom, I have to ask you about something. If the UN just disregarded everything that it's supposed to stand for and roll over like that and lick W's boots like that, what in the world was Bolton pissing and moaning about the UN about? What did he have to complain about the UN about if the UN was doing our bidding on all this stuff?
Well, yeah, we had John Bolton on this program a few months ago. Basically, he's taking the position, as most of the neocons are, that, number one, here you've got the United Nations, which is a world body that was created with a single purpose. And that is to promote peace in the world. And it is true. It is in our Constitution that when we sign a treaty, we surrender our own laws. In other words, if we signed a treaty with Canada that said if anybody says, I hate Canada, that they have to go to jail, it would become the law of the land. And, I mean, that's, it's in our Constitution. Treaties become the law of the land. And so the rap on the UN, going all the way back to the League of Nations, has always been, if we sign the treaties necessary to become a member of the United Nations, we're surrendering some of our sovereignty. And it's true. And to the extent that we're surrendering sovereignty, it's that we are agreeing not to attack other nations. That's what the UN was all about. It was a series of treaties that defined the parameters under which the world could go to war. That's why it was passed after war. That's why it was created after World War II, so that there would never be another World War II. And that surrender of sovereignty made a lot of people very, very frightened, frankly, a lot of particularly conservatives. And I remember, you know, I've told you about this before, back when I was 13 and campaigning for Barry Goldwater and reading John Stormer. And I was like, oh, my God, you know, it's there are communists in the U.N. And you know, and then you figure out, wait a minute, the U.N. has very limited power. And basically the treaties that we've signed say we will not go to war. We will not attack another country unless the world basically says, yeah, this country needs to be attacked. And if we say that and everybody else who's a member of the UN says that, then maybe we can stop war in the world. And wouldn't that be a fine thing? Now, you want to talk about the surrender. And so anyhow, that's Bolton's belly aching, is that, you know, the fact that the UN exists. I mean, he just, you know, doesn't like, you know, what? You got something that's preventing us from having wars? Now, you want a real surrender of sovereignty? Look at the World Trade Organization, which says that a corporation can sue our government or can sue your business, a corporation from some other country, because they don't like our practices. You know, for example, for 25 years, the Humane Society of the United States, along with a whole bunch of other groups, but they were the leader, tried to stop this practice of netting to catch tuna that killed dolphins, because dolphins tend to swim above where tuna are below, because as the tuna are feeding, the chum comes up above and the dolphins would eat it. And they just drop these giant nets and they kill all these dolphins. They drown them because they're air-breathing mammals. And so we finally said, can't do that anymore. You got to use hooks, or you got to use a technique that will only catch the tuna and the dolphins can survive. And we had this dolphin-safe tuna. And we signed the WTO and NAFTA, and Mexico sues us. And the Clinton administration actually supported them in their lawsuit of us, saying, that's illegal. You can't do that. That's illegal restraint of trade under NAFTA and the WTO. And they won. So, I mean, that, in my mind, is a real surrender of sovereignty. But anyhow, 1-866-303-2270, our number. Steve in Plainview, New York. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, how are you, Tom?
Just fine. What's up?
Listen, you're very smart, and the fact that you're shocked at anything that took place leading up to the invasion of Iraq, you and your listeners should read Marcus Aurelius and Meditations. There's nothing shocking.
I actually have, and from the Roman Empire, yeah. And I agree with you, and I'm not shocked by it. What I was shocked by was that Scott Pelley, who is supposed to be a reporter and should have been friggin' paying attention, was somehow under the impression that Saddam Hussein wasn't doing everything he could to prevent his country from being invaded and to comply with the inspectors.
There are no reporters. There are no Ted Koppel.
I know.
Reporter.
It's all infotainment.
They all
it's
get
all
their checks signed by Disney, General Electric, or Fox. There are no reporters. Only PR guys.
Yeah.
And anyway, I really called commenting about Teddy Kennedy's endorsement of Barack Obama. Yeah. Is this the same Teddy Kennedy that metaphorically took the Democratic Party off the bridge at Chappaquiddick around 1970?
Yeah, I think
this is the same guy.
Yeah, I think most of the country's kind of left that behind.
Yeah,
and Teddy Kennedy is viewed as an elder statesman these days.
No, I understand that. But there's a reason why the Republicans occupied the White House as a minority party for the last 28 years of 40 years. There's a reason. They're much more cunning. They're all licking their chops about running against Obama.
Oh, yeah.
They rigged Iowa. We know they rigged Iowa. Those are Republicans' votes. They gave Obama his plurality in Iowa. No
well, how do you know that, Steve? You're saying that Republicans showed up at the caucuses where people can see people from their own community, their own neighborhood?
Just look at the numbers. Look at the 240,000 numbers that were cast in Iowa.
So all those people who were representing themselves as independents who showed up at the caucuses, you see this as a Republican. The Republicans have decided they don't want to run against the white guy, John Edwards. They want to run against the woman or the black guy because they think they can beat them. Is that what you're suggesting?
The only way.
You know, I have heard that. I have seen that, frankly, on a number of conservative message boards.
Right.
That this is what it's all about.
How ill will John McCain look debating a Hillary Clinton or a John Edwards? the energy that they would put out there. How sick would Romney look? Forget anyone else. Forget even Huckabee. Because we're not going to even remember Huckabee's name in about 60 days.
Yeah, but the ultimate question, Steve, that you're asking, or the question that is raised by what you're saying, is America to the point where we can elect an African-American or a woman as president? And I'd say absolutely we are. The question is this the right African-American or the right woman? And
Correct.
For the Democratic Party.
I think, first of all, George Bush has lowered the bar so much that anyone could be elected.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mencken wrote this. I can go back to an article that H.L. Mencken wrote in the 1920s about the day that we would elect the dumbest guy in the room.
Yeah, and we did. No, I got it, Stephen. Your point is made. But I still think, having said all that, I just dropped a caller here by accident. I'm sorry. Having said all that, I still think that I am personally of the opinion that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are viable candidates, and either one of them would make a good president for the United States, even though neither of them are my first choice. And I think that they are electable. I really do. David in Ventura, California. Hey, David.
Yeah, hi. Tom, I'd like to speak for, I guess, virtually every one of your listeners in saying if what you just mentioned with this review, as the guy referred to the review, if that is not enough to get that guy, George W. Bush, up in front on charges in an international world court, could you please tell me what is, what would constitute a heinous enough crime to be prosecuted before the world?
The problem is that the United States has, you know, all this power with these world institutions, and we've got a lot of allies, and they're not going to embarrass Bush. You've got a whole lot of people who are holding power, and very few of them have very, very clean hands, whether it's the, you know, Sarkozy, or whether it's Brown, or whether it's, you know, whoever it's going to be. And they're all thinking someday down the road, this could be me. And, you know, so frankly, I think he's just going to get off scot-free. That's what I see coming. Joe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Joe. Hey, Joe, stick around for just a second. Let me pick you up on the other end. We got to take a break here. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 866-303-2270, our number, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com, if you want to drop into our blog, our websites. We'll be right back.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
The simple-minded and the uninformed can be easily led astray. And those that cannot connect the dots, hey, look the other way. People believe what they want to believe when it makes no sense at all. And I wish you all along sidelines. And the strength to walk down, walk tall.
Tom Hartman Program, brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, supporting your local radio station, getting out there and spreading the word, telling your friends to listen in, and by SEIU 1199, 200,000 health and hospital workers fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Okay, Judy in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Sorry I cut you off there, but when the music begins, I even have to submit. What's up, Judy?
I was calling. I wanted to just respond to all the people that are calling for John Edwards to drop his candidacy, or even the people who are saying they're sure that the only role he has to play in the convention is that of kingmaker. I mean, we haven't even had Super Tuesday yet. There's still another debate, and I think South Carolina really showed that when he has a chance to get his message out, because they can't shut him out of the debates, or at least they haven't tried yet, like they did to Dennis. You know, once his message is heard, his support grows. Like in the past 25 days, they said that his fundraising and donations have exceeded the whole last quarter, and over half of those people are new contributors. So he's obviously doing better and growing, and I think he's largely being written off and with no help of the media, you know.
Yeah, in my mind, the only person who can take John Edwards out of this race is John Edwards.
Agreed. Yeah, and I mean, I don't think he will drop out because all these people are calling for it, but it seems like even just the slightest bit of coverage that he does get in the media is people saying, oh, he should be dropping out, oh, he's not viable anymore. And it blows my mind. And with him not being included in these polls anymore, you know, they're faulting him for citing that poll in December, saying he's the only one that can beat all the Republicans by the margin of error, but they didn't include him in the next poll that they did.
No, I saw a couple of days ago there was one of the TV pundits had on, let's talk about Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and John Edwards. And then they had on somebody from the Obama camp and from the Clinton camp.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a debate between the two of them. And that was
awful.
It.
It makes me so mad. I read...
Well, there's a reason for it, though, Judy. And the reason why is because John Edwards is the anti-big, mega, monopoly corporate candidate.
Right.
That is the corporate media. So when you're talking about MSNBC, you're talking about General Electric and or Time Warner, CNN, and they are not going to have it. They're not going to have a guy who's president who they know is going to break up their big corporate monopolies and give them problems. And so anyhow, that's the bottom line. Charles in Atlanta. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I've listened to your show for a while now. Like kind of like your point of view, you're really interesting. But I want to make a point. I'm a black person.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear all these people calling up talking about how, Democrats are going to lose if they let Obama win, or, the Republicans are kind of like hoping for this. These people need to check their comments because black people have been loyal to the Republican Party for the last 40 years or so.
You mean the Democratic Party?
Pardon me?
You mean the Democratic Party?
Yes. And they've voted like 90% Democrat.
Yep.
And this Democratic Party is the base of the black people, African Americans are the base of the Democratic Party. And if we...
Well, they're a good chunk of the base. I'd say labor is a good chunk of the base. There are a lot of constituencies that make up the...
But your point
is well taken. I get it.
Yeah, and South Carolina, look at all the emphasis on that.
They moved
everything up for a reason.
Sure.
But the point I'm trying to make is that if we decide to go independent, Democratic Party will pretty much cease to be a viable party. There's still, like I said, 90% of black Americans vote. And if we decide not to really support that, become independent... And then we'll see how much loyalty people have for us.
Yeah, see, Charles, African Americans are facing the same problem in what you're identifying is the same problem that I'm facing if Hillary Clinton's the nominee.
Right.
And she and her strategists have made it very clear. We had one of them on this program a couple of weeks ago who said, basically we're assuming that even though progressives – don't think that Hillary's all that progressive. If she's the nominee, where are they going to go?
Let me make this one point before you go. The Republicans have made an argument, and it makes sense that, so-called white liberals, are really condescending toward blacks. And in some ways they are, because like I said, they have been taking black people there are a lot of issues in the black community that have not been addressed.
Yep.
Basically education, for one thing. The education system kind of sucks. You've been to an inner-city school lately?
Yeah, no, I've done consulting work with the Atlanta, back when we lived in Atlanta, with the inner city schools in Atlanta, and I can tell you,
it's hell. I grew up in the Midwest, and I understand that. The point I'm trying to make is that, just want to make this point, like I said, they need to check that attitude, because like I said, if blacks become independent, then their base will be the Labor Party, and the Labor Party is diminishing every minute.
Yeah, and I'm concerned, frankly, about progressives as well. What we're talking about here is the evolution of a circular firing squad. And we all need to stop it as quickly as we can. Charles, thank you for your comments. Your points are well made. Pat, Granite Falls, Washington. Hey, Pat.
Oh, I'm so glad to talk to you. Now, there are things that need to be said. Our great nation is made up of people from countries all over the world. I won't go through all of the nationalities, but all of these people of all nations and countries of the world are watching this next election in 2008. And it's excruciating to me to think that at this time in our country's history, we would be judging who we're going to vote for by the color of their skin. I'm going to make this a little shorter.
I agree with you, Pat, but let me tell you, there are still large chunks of America where you will have the experience, where you probably will still have the same experience that Louise had when we first moved to Atlanta back in 1983, where the real estate agent said, do you want to look at houses in the white section of town or in the mixed section of town? I mean, racism is alive and well in America, let me tell you.
Yes, and this is what I want to say. It is time that we grow up. We want to advance out of preschool and kindergarten and grow up and become adults and vote for the person who is going to help our country, and our country needs it desperately. And I would like to add
I'm sorry, Pat, but we're out of time. There's no time to add, but I appreciate your comments. And yeah, it is time for us to grow up, and it is time for us to say we're going to vote for the right person regardless of their race or their gender. Coming up tomorrow, Thomas Paine's birthday. Harvey Kay on Thomas Paine and the Province of America. We'll recap Bush's last State of the Union. What were the highlights and the lowlights, plus the best of the rest of the news right here. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.